In 1849, the first police chief of the city of New York reported that there were 3,000 children living on the city's streets. The city government of New York responded to the problem by rounding up these children and putting them in jail or in poorhouses. This morning on Focus 580, we'll be bringing you the story of a man who had a very different idea, a young minister named Charles Loring Brace. He believed that what these children needed were jobs and homes and education, and to that end, established the Children's Aid Society. Very quickly, the society became overwhelmed. The need was far greater than their resources, so Brace got an idea. He would send groups of children to the country in the hopes that they would be taken in. Inspired by that success, organizations in other cities put children on trains to the West and the Midwest, and between 1859 and 1929, something like 250,000 poor children were placed in rural homes by these programs. Not all of them went on to lead happy lives, but most apparently did. This morning, we'll be talking about how this all came to be and about the individual who started it. And our guest is Stephen O'Connor, and he explores this territory in his most recent book, which is titled Orphan Trains, the story of Charles Loring Brace and the children he saved and failed. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin, and it's out now in the bookstore. You want to take a look at it. Our guest, Stephen O'Connor, will be visiting here in Champaign-Urbana as part of the Robert J. Carr Visiting Writers Series, sponsored by the Creative Writing Program in the Department of English here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We're grateful to them for helping us to arrange this interview. Also, by the way, when he's here, he will be giving a reading from his latest book at the Illini Union Bookstore. This will be on Monday, next Monday, the 26th, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This is in the author's corner on the second floor. And if you're interested, you certainly should feel welcome to attend. And as we talk this morning with Stephen O'Connor, you're welcome to call in. Maybe you have questions or comments. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we do have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel. 800-222-9455. Just a little bit more about our guest. Stephen O'Connor is the author of Rescue, a collection of short fiction, a book that we discussed on this program some time back when it came out, a book titled Will My Name Be Shouted Out? That's nonfiction. It's about his years teaching creative writing in an inner city school in New York. He currently teaches creative writing at Lehman College and the New School. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. O'Connor, hello.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it very much. In reading the book, I think about the fact that today people might think of cities as being difficult places with high levels of things like poverty and crime and pollution. But I suspect if we could take people back to New York of the 1850s, they would be shocked.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's really quite amazing to read accounts of New York in the 1850s. I mean, not only was there very, very high levels of poverty and as a result, child vagrancy. I mean, really, I suppose the best way to think about any New York or any of the big older cities in America at that time is to think of them as third world cities, because they were very much undergoing the same kind of transformation from a sort of a traditional agrarian and crafts-based economy to an industrial capitalist economy. And at the same time, we're undergoing a huge immigration, both from within the United States and from abroad, of course. 1,000 people a day came into New York City during the mid-19th century. But also, one of the things that's really amazing in all of these accounts is how often people refer to the bad air. These cities absolutely stank. They had open sewers very often. They had, you know, no refrigeration. The butcher shops and the slaughterhouses were just open onto the street. All the houses burned, you know, coal and wood, so there was constantly smoke in the air. They were really quite horrific places. And, of course, people didn't bathe nearly as much then as they do now. So we would be very, very, very shocked if we were to see our great metropolis is 150 years ago.
Yeah, that was a time when the horse was still the mode of transportation. So the horse manure was probably a huge thing.
Horse manure, pig manure, dog manure. I mean, the streets were just filled with it. And a lot of the smaller streets, especially in the poorer areas, were dirt. And so Charles Dickens describes this one section of New York City called Five Points as the stinking and the mud being so deep that you could sink into it up to your thighs on rainy days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just really quite horrible.
To put this number, this 3,000 number, in some perspective, this was the number that the first police chief came up with. And here, I guess we also should say that we're just talking about Manhattan.
Right. New York, up until 1898, was only Manhattan. In 1898, the outer boroughs were incorporated into the city. But at that time, New York was Manhattan. Brooklyn was a separate city, and Queens, Bronx, and Staten Island were just rural. At that point, those 3,000 kids, now that's just one estimate. There were other estimates at the time that put the number at 10,000, even as high as 40,000. But 3,000 was something like two-thirds of one percentage point of the city's population were children living on the streets. So it was a very, very big problem. These kids were, you know, newsboys, street sweepers, apple sellers, corn sellers, but they were also thieves, beggars, and especially for the girls, they were prostitutes. Mm-hmm. Prostitution was really an enormous problem in the 19th century.
One of the things that you point out in the book is that the term that came to be applied to these trains, orphan trains, is something of recent coinage. The people at the time who organized this didn't call them that. And in fact, these children were not all orphans. I guess maybe half of them were, but of the kind of children that we're talking about, half of them did have at least one parent, if not two. Why were these children living on the street?
Well, for many, many reasons. I mean, one thing we have to understand about poverty in the 19th century is that it existed in without the safety net that we have now. You know, if you look at it just in terms of the economic system, under a crafts-based economy or on a farm, on a farm or in a shop or, whatever, if the father fell sick, the wives and the children could all sort of take over some of his duties sort of keep the farm going, keep the shop going. If prices fell, well, they just lowered their prices and they worked harder and they could sort of compensate for it to some extent. But once we had a wage economy, if the father, let's say, worked in a foundry, lost his job, there was no way that his wife, who was doing the needle trades, very, very low-paying work, by the way, there was no way that she could take over his job in the foundry. So the family was just on the street. Of course, with this, and there was no Social Security, there was no unemployment insurance, no disability insurance, even though people were very often injured because the factories were terribly dangerous in those days. There was no welfare. There was really nothing to protect people, and so they were at a great risk of economic catastrophe. And of course, along with that risk, there was great psychological pressure, which is the kind of thing that makes people very unhappy and destroys families. So you have a whole nexus of problems developing. You've got people just losing work, ending up on the street. You've got tents, people who maybe are fighting and drinking too much, making a home a miserable place, and the kids are running away. But also you have this phenomenon, which is, I think, we don't really understand nowadays, but during the 19th century, working class and poor people very, very commonly sent their children away from home to work. That was the whole premise of the indenture system, which, you know, was dying out in the mid-19th century, that children would go away from home to work. Children at a very young age would go off on their own to find jobs. You know, the kids in the city would go out into the country to find jobs on farms, or they'd go from the country back into the city to find jobs as shop boys or whatever. They would get jobs as cabin boys. They would get jobs on canal boats. Children worked. They were, in a way, one of the things that really struck me when I first began to work on this book was that the 19th century was filled with its Huckleberry Finns. You know, we think of Huckleberry Finn as a kind of a preternaturally mature child, but in fact, it was just very common for children to be independent in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the migration to the Midwest and to the West, we tend to think of it as a kind of a, almost like Star Trek, people boldly going where no man had gone before, that kind of thing. But in fact, these are just people who are looking for work.
Yeah.
And very often what would happen is the families would come to New York, they'd arrive in New York from Ireland or Italy or from wherever. They couldn't find work because, of course, again, with 1,000 people a day coming in, I mean, you can imagine that the job market is pretty tight.
Hmm.
So the families would leave, but sometimes a child may have had a good job. And so they would leave the child behind because they didn't want that child to, you know, suffer the risks of Western migration unnecessarily. One last point about this, too, is that working-class families throughout the 19th century depended on their children for about 50% of their income. So that shows, you know, how much these children were working in whatever capacity.
Yeah. Well, I think it also serves as a reminder to us that at that time, people didn't think about children the way we think about children now. I think there was much more of a tendency to think of a child as merely a small adult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, people understood that children were different, but the differences were not conceived of in the way that we conceive of them now. To some extent, they just didn't have the luxury to see children as, let's say, vulnerable and innocent, and so they didn't. One thing that was really is quite remarkable is to see, especially on the issue of children's vulnerability, people in the mid-19th century, when it was really necessary for these kids to have a lot of independence and to travel and to work on their own, often did not see these children as being in great danger when they would go by themselves at 10 years old from the city out into the country or go work on a cabin boy. In the late 19th century, as a result of many things, partly as a result of the growth of unions, which did not like child labor because it was essentially the children were in competition with the adult male workers, the heads of the households, and they were keeping those salaries for the heads of the household down because, of course, children were worked for a pittance, and so unions were opposed to it. Public education advocates were opposed to it because they thought that children should be educated, that the American worker needed to be educated in order to be, you know, primed for the new economy. I mean, something we keep hearing today. But also, the American Association for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children was founded in 1875 as a result of a celebrated case of child abuse. And with that, people began to have a new understanding of you know, what even parents could do to their children, because the propaganda from the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children was widely circulated, and all these factors together changed people's notions of what danger children could be subjected to. But I guess to go back to my original point, one of the things that really is really striking is that as unions raised the salaries of the male head of the household, and as families became more and more capable of living on one income, they then were able to see the children as vulnerable, and so they started to see them as vulnerable. You know? And to some extent, I think that these were—it was just sort of suppressed impulses or suppressed knowledge came to the surface once it was possible. In any event, that resulted in a major change in the way Americans thought children should be treated, and how they should be protected, and to what extent they should be protected. Yeah. And I can certainly see how our modern attitudes grew out of that change.
I should introduce again our guest for anyone who's tuned in the last little bit here. We're talking with Stephen O'Connor. He's the author of the book Orphan Trains, The Story of Charles Loring Brace and the Children He Saved and Failed. That's the subtitle. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. I also should have mentioned, I guess, at the beginning of the program that we have an extra copy of the book and we'd like to give it away. And we'll be doing that at about the midpoint, so maybe in about 10 or 12 minutes from now. We'll give you a telephone number to call the first person in. We'll get the book. I'm sorry that we only have one. So, but we'd at least like to find a home for that one. And, of course, anybody else, if you're interested in the book, you can head out to the bookstore. And also, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, our guest Stephen O'Connor, will be giving a reading from the book on Monday at the Illini Union Bookstore on the U of I campus. So there's an opportunity to hear more from him and have a copy of the book if you want. Questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a caller to start with here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
There's some comment earlier about a different attitude toward children at that time. They were regarded as being little adults, and I think that's true to some point, but I think they're really pertinent. Difference is that those who were in power considered that they had no responsibility for the welfare of any of the lower classes, and the children were to be disregarded as much as any other person. Within the lower middle class and working class families, I suspect there was quite a bit of concern about children, but no opportunity to care for them better.
I think that's an absolutely fair point, and to some extent that is, I think, you know, in a more concise form, precisely what I was trying to spell out, you know, in my most recent remarks there. You know, I mean, it is always important to remember how complex the pictures, you know, the people's attitudes actually were, because of course, I mean, as you say, I think that they're just people. Didn't have the working class and poor people didn't have the opportunity to really indulge their concerns about their children. You know, they just had to face what they saw as the facts of life, and to some extent that meant, you know, sort of pushing aside their anxieties. The upper classes were had all the prejudices against the poor that frankly persist to this day, they were very afraid of the poor, both as, you know, criminals, potential criminals, but also as revolutionaries. I mean, they were very, very worried about revolution, especially after 1848, where there had been all these revolutions in Europe. But at the same time, there was, you know, there was concern for the children as well. I mean, and the Children's Aid Society depended upon that. And in the sort of the fundraising literature that Charles Loring Brace wrote, he played up to the concern of the moneyed classes for these poor children who they saw all around them on the streets. So it's not a simple attitude. It's very complex, and it's one of the reasons why it's hard to make generalizations about history, because almost everything. About an entire era, of an entire attitude, because almost everything you say, you can find an exception to. But in general, I agree with your point.
It seems to me we are drifting back toward that attitude in the...
Oh, yes, I think we certainly are. I mean, the truth of the matter is that I don't think we've ever drifted terribly far away from that attitude, but certainly we are, you know, it is stronger now, and it's been strong, you know, over the last... 20 years or so, it's been, you know, quite strong, and stronger than it had been, let's say, in the previous 20 years.
I appreciate the comments of the call. Let's go on to another person here. This would be Belgium next, line number 4. Hello?
Hello. One of Mr. Inge's guests who hosts the Midnight Special, and Mr. Inge has regularly, has a folk song type genre to his show. And on one of his Mr. Inge's interviews with him, he suggested an artist called Tom Russell. And this artist is a phenomenal folk-type singer, and one of his songs is called The Orphan Train.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about this particular situation, but from the child's point of view.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, a number of people have been writing songs about the orphan trains recently.
Is that right?
And of course, there have also been some plays and musical, and like there are a number of sort of one person shows going on, mainly in the Midwest, actually. And
a lot of them came here. That'd probably be a reason to be here.
Yes. I'd heard actually that I think when the musical had come through. Urbana-Champaign, and had been a big hit. Yeah, I've never seen any of them, but I have heard about them, and you know, it's a very compelling story, and you know, the stories of the kids are an important part of my book. I mean, it's about Charles Loring. I use Charles Loring Brace as a sort of a mechanism for talking about social attitudes, and about the moral obligation that he felt, and that to some extent I think we all have, to do what we can do for, you know, children who are really deeply, deeply needy and troubled. But much of the book is also about the lives of individual children.
So I
speak from their perspective as well.
Yeah, the aspect this song told was the unfortunate aspect that these children were never able to find their siblings or other relatives, because all of the records were always destroyed.
Well, that's complicated too. We know what the Children's Aid Society did. I mean, I haven't really said anything about how the orphan trains process. You know, where children were actually placed via the orphan trains. But essentially, what they would do is the Children's Aid Society would have a local committee that would, you know, sort of set up, let people in the area know that a group of homeless children were going to be coming, and they would want homes, and they would want places to work. People would then, the train would arrive, the kids would be unloaded, they might go to a church or a meeting house, and then a group of the local residents who had heard about their arrival would come and look at them. And if, you know, a local resident wanted to take a child home for whatever reason, they would approach the agent of the Children's Aid Society who would accompany the children. Or actually of any of the other organizations that, that did this. Many, many other organizations also put children on orphan trains. The Children's Aid Society was the sort of in the vanguard, but they were not alone. But in any event, they would these people would then, you know, talk to the agent and talk to the members of the local committee. And if the local committee hadn't heard any bad things about these people, if they looked, you know, sort of clean and respectable, they were allowed to take the child home. And the first priority in orphan train placement was the placement of the child. That was the main thing they wanted to do. But they did try to keep siblings together. That was a very important thing. And, you know, but if they couldn't do it, well, they didn't do it. Then they would try to put siblings on neighboring farms. That was a very common thing. But sometimes it just didn't happen. You know, the siblings were placed quite a distance. In regard to the communication and the records, indeed, the records were very poor in the beginning of the orphan train program, partly because no one had ever had to keep track of so many children over such a long period of time before, and people really didn't know what to put into the records. It's quite funny it's interesting as you look at the records of the Children's Aid Society to see them sort of stumbling about trying to figure out what they actually needed to say about these kids. Early on, the records are very sparse, but also early on, one of the things that's really remarkable about Brace is that he had a great deal of respect for these children and for their capacity to make their own decisions about their own lives. One of the things he wanted to do with the orphan trains was to encourage the children to, you know, be independent and to rely on their own strength. And they, you know, he had no objection to their keeping in touch with their siblings, going to visit their siblings, or even leaving their placements and going off to be with their siblings or coming back to New York and being with their parents if the parents were still alive. It was only later on in the late 19th century that people began to develop this notion that I think is just beginning to pass away now, that the best thing for the children was to put their parents behind them forever and never have any contact with them again and pretend that they are the natural children of the people who had taken them in. But that wasn't true in the early days. There was much more flexibility, so kids had more contact. It was mainly within the 20th century that kids had difficulty keeping in touch with their relatives, although even then the Children's Aid Society in particular did make it possible for kids to visit. And the very last, you know, kids to go out on the orphan trains, the last official train went out in 1929, but for several years afterwards they continued to sneak kids out so that they could be, you know, that the younger children, the younger siblings of siblings who had already been placed on the orphan trains, they'd be sort of snuck out and placed with their siblings. So they were trying then to keep them together. So again, we get another generalization that is partly true, but partly not true, and it's, you know, it's just again shows what a complex picture all of this really is.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, I mentioned about 10 minutes ago that we have an extra copy of the book that we would like to give away, and at this point here, we would like to do that. So, here's what you need to do: you need to give us a call at this number. I will give it in a moment, and the first person, we'll just do it like that. The first person who gets in, we will send them a copy of the book Orphan Trains. And as I said, I'm sorry we just have one to give away, but at least we'll do that. And then you can go down to the bookstore and look for the book. So here's the number, 333-0852. You can start calling right now, and as soon as we know that it's gone, it probably went that fast. I have a feeling so. Probably if you didn't get in right away, we're sorry. But again, you can go down to the bookstore and find it. And Stephen O'Connor, our guest, is going to be giving a reading from the book on Monday on the U of I campus at the Illini Union Bookstore, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So you'll have an opportunity to meet him, if you like, and hear more about the book. And, of course, here, questions are welcome. And again, the number to call in, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. The book is, in part, a biography of this man that we've been talking about, Charles Loring Brace, who was the founder of the Children's Aid Society, was the executive director for 37 years, right up until the time that he died. And then when he died, one of his children took over. So he was associated with this for a large part of his life. What about him, his upbringing, his background, steered him in the direction of being involved with social welfare issues?
Well, he came from an upper-middle-class family in Hartford, Connecticut, that were very, very involved with all sorts of social issues I suppose it was a group of people that saw themselves as, to some extent, playing a role in the forging of the new nation that we were living in. His father was a teacher at one of the first women's secondary schools in the country, the Litchfield Female Academy, and he taught there, among other people, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who went on to write Uncle Tom's Cabin, among other books.
Well, the Beechers were family friends of of his family,
and Lyman Beecher, Harriet's father, was an activist minister who was the founder of the sort of social reform movement under which missions would be established in cities, and they would try to sort of save the poor, great unwashed classes, from their immorality and sort of put them on the straight and narrow path to moral behavior. And it was assumed that as a consequence of moral behavior, sort of financial security. In any event, that Brace and his family were very much a part of that whole world. Brace was studied to be a minister, came at it his charitable work with a deep moral passion. To some extent, he really felt his idea of Christ was that Christ was sort of a worker among the poor. And Brace, all of his life, and not always in the most humble terms, saw himself as emulating Christ, as sacrificing himself for the, for the benefit of the poor. Of course, it was a sacrifice that elevated him to a fair degree of fame and social prestige. Nonetheless, this was the way he conceived of it. And it's easy to mock him and to mock many Victorians for some of the hypocritical aspects of their moral commitment. But I am very interested in the seriousness with which he and his friends took their own moral development and their obligations to, perform good actions, to do the right thing. One of his best friends growing up was Frederick Law Olmsted, who was, among other things, the designer of Central Park and many of other parks all across America. And Olmsted and Brace were constantly trying to find ways to sort of to help each other be better people. And, for them, this sort of challenge to be good was sort of like a marathon is to a jogger or a promising startup is to a venture capitalist. I mean, these were great challenges. They ran risks, but they were what life was all about. They made life exciting. We don't have that same attitude nowadays towards being good. And I can't help feeling that perhaps there's some kind of a loss, even though the Victorian notion of goodness often involved a lot of hypocrisy. Partly his own particular background, partly the attitude of the society that brought him into this. He initially began to work with kids when he came to New York City in 1848 to study theology at Union Theological Seminary. And as a part of his work there, was doing charitable work on what was then called Blackwell's Island, is now Roosevelt Island, and was a place where the city dumped all of its human garbage. It had its insane asylum, its charity hospital, its prisons, its almshouses. And when Brace was there, he just saw the most horrific examples of human suffering and was really quite taken by it. And then later on began to work instead of working in the prisons and the institutions where these people were kept, he began to work in the communities where they were living, but ultimately became very frustrated in his work with poor adults. They they refused to be helped by him. This infuriated him. You know, his way of conceiving of it was that they were lost. But the children, he felt, were more malleable and were younger and could be saved. And sometime in the early 1850s, he decided that, you know, really the best work he could do would be to work with children, and he founded the Children's Aid Society in 1853.
Yeah. At the beginning, as I was introducing the story, I talked about the fact that he was involved in the founding of this organization, and that it didn't take very long before he and the people that he was working with realized they were overwhelmed. How is it that he hit on this idea of taking the children and placing them in homes in rural parts of the country?
Well, there are many precedents for that. The most important one is the indenture system, under which children were already doing that. Also, children were already going out from the cities of the country anyway. Brace looked at it as, just on purely economic terms, part of the time, you know, the cities, there were few jobs, the pay was low. In the country, there were lots of jobs and few workers, and if maybe not the pay, but the economic rewards of farm life in those days were seen as quite solid and secure. So he just was sort of going along with something that was already happening. He was facilitating something that children were already doing themselves. But also, before the Children's Aid Society, as you mentioned in your very good introduction, what people were doing with these street kids was just throwing them into jail. Well, they invented the juvenile prison in the early 19th century, and the juvenile prisons would frequently indenture the children, that is, send them off into the country to work for farmers. But they also wanted to get them as far away from the influence of their parents. There was one juvenile prison in Philadelphia, for instance, that indentured a kid to someone in Peru to get them away from their parents. But so there were these precedents, and then the last factor was that the treasurer of the Children's Aid Society had worked for an organization called the Boston Children's Mission to the Children of the Homeless, which had been sending children out on trains to Western Massachusetts and New England, where they would be indentured to farmers. And so Brace knew about this through the treasurer, so that was, again, something that, just another precedent.
Hmm. I'm sure that some, maybe many, of the families that took these children in thought that they were indeed doing God's work, and what they were doing was adopting a child. That is, they were getting getting a son or a daughter.
Right.
I'm sure that some of them also simply looked at them as another pair of hands, and what they were doing was they were getting a servant.
Right.
And so the experiences of these children were not uniform. Some were bad. Probably most were pretty good, given the fact that we're talking about a lot of different children with different experiences. What can you say about what kind of life these children had?
Well, I'm not sure that most were pretty good, actually.
Mm.
I suspect that it probably was very much like foster care nowadays. I mean, so they had everything from quite good placements to all the horrific stories that we hear, about abuse and the murder of children. I mean, all these things happen to these kids. The orphan trains were the origin of foster care. Modern foster care, and adoption, actually. All of the organizations that sent out orphan trains by the early 20th century had primarily become foster care and adoption agencies, as the Children's Aid Society is today. It is hard to tell exactly what happened to these kids because the records were not very complete, especially in the early days of the orphan train movement. You've got to remember that these are kids who came from very difficult circumstances. They primarily ended up coming to the Children's Aid Society as a result of some kind of calamity in their life, an economic calamity, the death of parents, drunkenness in the family, abuse. Many of the kids were runaways. But in any event, these are kids that have had a hard life, and they go out, and they will be placed with families who, even if they wanted to do the right thing, may not really have been capable of doing it. And this was a major criticism that was made by people opposed to the orphan train movement in the 19th century. So sometimes, they would go out, they would act up, and the people would sort of just clamp down on them and punish them and so forth. The kids would be miserable. that doesn't necessarily mean that they ended up having worse lives than they would have had they stayed in New York. One thing that really struck me when I spoke to several of the last orphan train riders, and all of them, every single one of them, said that they felt that even though they had had real hardship in their new placements, that they would have been better off, they were better off having gone, you know, to the Midwest or to the Far West than to have stayed on the streets of New York City. That may be true, but it may also reflect people's inability to really consider seriously the thought that their whole life was a mistake, that they might have really lived better lives had they had, another fate. Another criticism that was leveled at the Children's Aid Society, and frankly is still being leveled at our child welfare agencies now, was that what these kids really needed, the best thing to have done to help these children would have been to help their families, would have been to help the family stay together, help tide them over during economic emergencies, help them find jobs, homes, whatever, give them the little bit of help they needed to get back on their feet. America has always been very, very reluctant to do that, for reasons that are understandable, but perhaps don't really make sense in the long run. I mean, Americans basically have never wanted to give the poor, who are primarily seen as you know, at least potential criminals, addicts, drunks, whatever. They never want to sort of reward them for their poverty. People also have never wanted the children of these people to have advantages that the children of, you know, hardworking taxpayers don't have, and so they've been very reluctant to give children these sorts of benefits. And this has been true throughout the history of any social mechanism for dealing with poverty. But the fact remains that it's actually cheaper to help families stay together, and it's probably better for the kids, and it may have been better for some of these orphan train riders, if they had, instead of leaving their families, that someone had helped their family in some way get through their catastrophe, that leading to the breakup of the family. And, so the whole issue, again, is very, very complex. Maybe it was better for them to leave, but maybe it would have been better to stay, provided they could have gotten the families could have gotten the services that they needed. But would that have happened? Hmm. Who knows?
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Stephen O'Connor. The book, again, is Orphan Trains. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Is available in the bookstore now. Stephen O'Connor will be giving a reading from the book on Monday on the U of I campus at the Illini Union Bookstore. One thing I did not mention, this reading is going to be filmed for C-SPAN Book TV. Well, that may influence your desire to be part of it. Hopefully it would make you want even more to go and go down there and hear from him. So that's your opportunity if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana. We do have a caller, someone to talk with in Crete, Illinois, so let's do that. And it's line number 4. Hello?
Yes, concept of Horace Greeley was taken literally, it seems, by Mr. Brace. Go west, young man, go west. Also, I would like to add that this idea of little adults is now very much part of the criminal justice system, and we don't really think these are children any longer. We think these are just little adults, and they should be given life sentences, but that's my personal philosophical point. I'd like to ask the author about the question of crime and gangs and immigration, and Catholics and Irish, etc. Isn't this in part, maybe subconsciously, unconsciously, an attempt to disrupt the increasing crime problem among the young, especially the gangs, the Irish gangs and the American gangs? And isn't there some somewhat anti-immigrant feeling behind some of this, anti-Catholic feeling, get them Protestantized, get them into the Western Americanized movement of the 19th century?
Yes, that's a very, very, very important point. And in fact, the strongest and to some extent perhaps the most effective criticism that was protest that was mounted against the Children's Aid Society was by the Catholic organizations. Indeed, there was, Brace had, again, complicated attitudes towards these kids. You know, he was a kind of an inverted social Darwinist. He believed that the normal social Darwinist believes that the wealthy are the finest examples of sort of human evolution. Price believed that the poor kids were the finest examples because they were bred in the areas where the struggle to survive was most fierce. But it is true that most of those kids in those slums were Catholic, or a very, very high percentage of them. And it is also true that although Brace said that the Children's Aid Society was a non-sectarian organization, he was himself a Protestant and was really deeply prejudiced against Catholics. And when he took those kids from the cities and put them out into the country where most people were Protestant, most of these kids ended up converting to Protestantism, or at least a very high percentage of them. Catholics saw this as a plot to wipe their religion out, and they combated it in many ways, in many very interesting ways. One was the New York Foundling Hospital was the other major organization that to send orphan trains out. These children, however, were only sent to Catholic families, and a provision of their placement was that they had to be raised Catholic. Another very interesting Catholic response that the Children's Aid Society was to enact all sorts of programs to enable Catholic families to stay together. Beginning in around 1863, a man named Levi Sliman Ives, who was a priest, established the Catholic Protectory. And it had many programs. One of them was they would, rather than taking the kids away from the families and sending them out west, they would put the kids in orphanages or sort of kind of reform schools where they would be trained ostensibly. I mean, these places often end up being very barbaric, but that was the idea, was to train these kids and kept in close contact with their parents so that they would then go back to their parents once whatever problems had arisen seemed to have been taken care of. Another thing they did was that they began making payments to single mothers to enable them to keep their children. This was really the beginning of welfare. And this was seen as a way of combating the problems that had led to the orphan trains. And indeed, in 1935, when the Roosevelt administration enacted welfare, it was very much conceived of as a mechanism for keeping children with their families so that they didn't have to be given up to orphanages or to be sent west on the orphan train. So there's a direct correlation between, to some extent, welfare was developed in opposition to mechanisms like the orphan trains.
But any statistical background and the information regarding whether they were Catholic or Protestant, whether they were average age of 10, whether they were...
Complicated. To be honest, I don't remember exactly what percentage of them were Catholic. Average age, they tended to be 12 to 14 was the main age of the orphan.
Mostly males?
60% male, 40% female.
Mostly sent to Colorado, Utah, places like that?
The state that got the greatest number was New York State.
New York.
Yeah. The Midwestern states, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, also got very high numbers. In the end, the last states to get them were Texas, Nebraska, Iowa. That was where the greatest concentration was, although the Foundling Hospital sent a very large number of children to Louisiana.
Any blacks?
There were very few blacks placed by the Children's Aid Society or by the Foundling Hospital, for obvious reasons, for the Foundling Hospital. However, the Children's Aid Society did place some blacks, primarily in Delaware and Maryland, where I think they had some sort of a network among black farmers. Brace was a very strong, very committed abolitionist, and I think was concerned that these children would be used as slave labor if they were just sort of sent out.
Sound like this would make a great screenplay.
It could. It'd be a great movie.
Good luck with it.
All right. Thanks for the call. I'm really interested to hear just the detail about the fact that Brace, not only was he a Protestant, but was maybe strongly anti-Catholic. It makes me think about the fact that in New York City, up until late 60s, placement of foster children was really dominated by religious organizations, primarily Catholic and Jewish organizations.
Right.
And just recently I talked with Nina Bernstein about her book, The Lost Children of Wilder, about the fact that that children who were either minority or Protestant, there was no one wanted to place them, and that they were children who really slipped through the cracks. And indeed, a lot of as late as the early 70s, when this this case came, it was charging essentially that the system was unconstitutional, that indeed children were still being put into reform schools and prisons because they just had no other way to deal with it.
One of the, you know, one of the ugly elements of American culture that we see when we look at this kind of story is the fact that, you know, in the early part of the 20th century, the Protestant agencies were probably dominant in New York, although the Catholic and the Jewish agencies were becoming very, very strong. But the Protestant agencies really began to lose ground when the number of black children that were that came to New York and were taken care of by these agencies began to increase. Because what happened was that the Protestant donors stopped giving money, whereas the Catholic and the Jewish agencies were able to maintain, you know, sort of more homogeneous culturally, and they continued to get their donations, and so they continued to grow, and the Protestant agencies shrunk, and the result was that Protestant kids ended up suffering, you know, as a result of that. I mean, this is you know more true in New York City, because New York City has this system of providing most of its care for foster children through the private sector rather than through the public sector. This is something that is, you know, being talked about, but being sort of spread throughout the country. I mean, I know that Jeb Bush, for instance, is very interested in doing it in Florida, but it's got major problems. One of them being the one I've just outlined. Another one being that there's tremendous communication problems. It's very hard to coordinate a system like that. Another being the private agencies have a certain incentive to keep kids in foster care because they get paid for it. And that's not always the best thing for the kids. So, again, we find ourselves in a very complex situation, and a situation that's only made more complex by the fact that throughout history, all efforts to help poor people, and I'm including publication in this, have never, ever been funded at the level that would allow them to operate according to their original design. They've always had to sort of make do, to sort of patch things over, with the result that they have, you know, they become corrupt, they're tremendously inefficient, and there's public outrages that then, you know, that then they're penalized, but to some extent they're being penalized for having never. All these organizations are themselves neglected and abused kids. And, you know, they've been neglected and abused throughout history, and the result is they grow up, they have behavior problems.
We are going to have to stop. I wish we could continue, but for now, we're going to have to leave it. But we want to mention again that our guest, Stephen O'Connor, will be here visiting Champaign-Urbana. His visit sponsored by the Creative Writing Program in the Department of English at U of I. We want to thank our friend Philip Graham for helping us to arrange this interview. Stephen will be making an appearance. He'll read from his latest book, Orphan Trains, the story of Charles Loring Brace and the children he saved and failed, Monday on the 26th, 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore. So anyone's welcome to stop by. It's being filmed for C-SPAN Book TV. Mr. O'Connor, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.